Good morning, everyone. Talk Radio 930 WTAD. The cat herding has begun on the Mary Griffith Show because it's really the Jack Freiberg and Chuck Schultz Show, as it is every Friday this time. And they have brought a special guest with them again, gracing our studios, Mr. Phil Bradshaw, proudly wearing his soybean checkoff shirt. Always a soybean guy, right?
Always a soybean guy.
We're so glad to
have
you.
He wrote the book on soybeans, literally.
Literally wrote the book on soybeans. And we're going to talk today about what tariffs might mean to soybeans. But first, let's introduce the Honorable Chuck Schultz, former mayor of Quincy, member of the Adams County Bicentennial Commission.
Now I'm just the old gray mayor, Jack. Ain't what he used to be.
Yes, but you still show up at every gathering with over 50 people.
Well, that is true.
My wife reminds me every day I'm not the mayor anymore. But.
Yeah. You still are. You're the honorary mayor.
Thank you, Mary.
Honorary mayor. And Jack Freiberg has never held any political office that I know of, but... He could be the mayor of Quincy. Have you ever thought about running?
No, not really.
No, okay. Well, you're too old anyway.
That's true, too. But I have this thing that I refer to as my grief-to-income ratio. And there are some things that are so much that no matter what the income is, it's just not worth it. And I think being mayor of Quincy, for me, would be over that.
You know, so. We had a thing on this morning. We were talking on the morning show with Scott. And I were about how even people that make $100,000 a year, which is a pretty good income, still have to have a side hustle to make it. So it's kind of interesting. So I'm going to go around the horn. Mr. Bradshaw, we'll start with you. If you had to have a side hustle where you had to make a little extra money to make ends meet, to get that mortgage payment in, to buy that wife whatever she needed, you know, what would your side hustle be?
Well, probably something that was public service in some way. I don't know whether I never ran for an office, but I probably would chose something as a public servant if it'd pay enough, you know.
Yeah, well, if it'd pay enough. That leaves that out.
He knows his way around the halls of Congress.
That
and
is
he's
true.
Been a very
he could be a lobbyist. You could be a lobbyist.
Well, I have been. I was a lobbyist for DeKalb in Springfield for a short period of time.
Oh, wow, I bet that paid some good money.
Well, it was better than farming. But I just went over whenever they needed something.
You know the joke about the farmer that won the lottery? Where there were a couple of them. One guy thought he'd maybe retire, go on vacation. The other guy said, I think I'll just keep farming until I lose it all.
Keep farming until it's all gone.
I hope not.
I had the director of one of the airlines that used to serve Quincy a long time ago on. And I said... wow, it must be pretty neat to own your own airline. You must be pretty rich. He goes, you know how to become a millionaire in the airline industry? He says, start with $30 million, and in a few years, you'll just be a millionaire. Jack Freiberg, what will your side hustle
be? Oh, I've got a high side hustle. I'm a picker. I buy and sell stuff, primarily hunting and fishing stuff, but... If I find something, for instance, just recently I found a Howard Miller clock that I bought very reasonably, and I sold it to the new clock shop in Hannibal.
So I've already got a side hustle. And Chuck Schultz, besides being a telephone operator, what would your side hustle be?
Well, over the years, especially in my younger married life with two growing boys, I would teach as an adjunct faculty member, and I've done that at QU. I've done it at Culver Stockton. I've done it at John Wood. And I'll tell you, it's not even minimum wage. I mean, I could have filed a complaint with the Department of Labor on that. Even me, who I think, I can walk in and talk to these kids for an hour, right? Right off the top of my head.
No. You got to grade the papers,
yeah. You got to grade the papers. You got to do your preparation. There's no free lunch there. We should all get organized as adjunct professors.
Yeah, that there's a
labor.
There's a union. That's what you can be, the union organizer for adjunct professors. Well, I tell you what, I know you're very devoted to Quincy and would never leave, but if there was an adjunct professorship in maybe Honolulu or something, that would be worth it.
St. Simon's Island.
Okay. Well,
Coastal College is there.
You already have housing.
Well, we got a little family place.
If you teach out at Stanford, they have to give you housing because nobody can afford to be out
there.
So they have a whole campus. Yeah. You know how they usually have dorms for kids? They don't care where the kids go. They're not worried about them. They have housing for the faculty. I was just out there. Well, let's talk today about why you're here, Mr. Bradshaw, not about your side hustle, although it could be male model. Or Chippendale Dancing in Las Vegas.
At 5'5" on a male model, I think that'd be a little unusual.
Well, you know.
And at 86 years old, I think that'd be a little unusual.
Well, I was just in Las Vegas. Trust me, you look just like those Chippendale guys that approached me on the strip. But we're here today to talk about tariffs. Mm-hmm. Now, the problem with this topic is, which Jack recommended, and I'm sure Chuck concurs, it's very difficult to talk about the Trump tariffs because he changes his mind every day. Mm-hmm. However, while he's going back and forth, trying to decide what the economic policy will be for our country, I want to get your take on tariffs in general and, you know, not to lambast the president or anything mm-hmm. like that, or not to support the president, mm-hmm. but just to say, what is your take on tariffs in general? What has your experience been with them? Because you've been to China, you've had a large career in agriculture, you have opened markets to foreign countries, you have been a trade ambassador all your life, formally and informally, mm-hmm. for U.S. agriculture. So I want to get from the expert what your thought is on these tariffs.
Well, first of all, I'm not an expert. And secondly, I don't think I have any greater knowledge other than I've had some experience, you know. And tariffs have always been used. Some people don't realize that, you know, we've had tariffs for years at different levels. I think the biggest thing President Trump has done is brought that to the public worldwide, to the fact these tariffs have been used correctly, incorrectly, whatever you believe.
Countries have tariffs against us, and he's like, hey, if you're going to do it against us, we're going to do it against you.
And how many people really realized, I didn't, even when I was been involved in this, you know, when I was chairman of the soybean board, we had people in 90 countries around the world, and I really didn't talk much about. I could go into details, but I did go to the embassy in Bonn back before in the old GATT days, and we had a big reception there because of a trade deal that had been put together, and soybean farmers wasn't liking it, so we went over there, hosted a meeting. I could talk about that the whole time if you want me to, but and we got it all worked out. But the real truth of the matter is, I think the biggest benefit from what President Trump has done is he has brought it to the attention of people worldwide. I think there's people in Europe and people in China and Latin America and Canada who never really realized the effect that tariffs have had. And I think on the short term, it's going to be inflationary. There's no question about that. I don't think so. But I think in the long term, I think it will be beneficial to everybody in the world. I think if we saw that the 90-day extension that they got with China the other day, I think there's all going to be good. But on the short term, there's no question about it. It's going to be inflationary.
Well, why don't we just have no tariffs? Why don't we just have zero tariffs then? I mean, it seems to be such a tit-for-tat thing. Where are tariffs most necessary for the United States? Let's just start with that. What is it that we're trying to protect that you absolutely, you know, say this has to happen? We have to have a tariff on this, because if we don't have a tariff on this, we're not protecting our own self-interest.
Well, I think one of the biggest thing you have to say on that is around the world, and China I think is a big one on this, is they use very almost slave labor, and our labor force cannot compete with that. I mean, you have to do something to offset that, because there are dictatorships, and I don't know that I 100%, matter of fact, we'll get into that in a minute if you want to. I have a little different view about China than what you see in the national press, but I think that is one of the big things, Mary, that you have to remember, is that some of these countries will make slaves out of people, and we can't compete with slave labor. And you know, we can be as efficient as we want to and maybe make a big headway, so I think your government has to say, now, listen, we can't let you bring in these products if you're going to have people, you know, slaves producing these things. So I think that's a big one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I think everybody would agree. You know, it's interesting as we all sit here proclaiming all of us to be Christians. If we would just be Christians,
yes,
we wouldn't
absolutely
need tariffs, we wouldn't have slave labor,
right,
we wouldn't have any
right
of these problems. But,
that's
of course,
right,
that's mm-hmm not the way the world is. So, obviously, we want to tariff or tax. It's just a fancy word for tax.
Yes,
tariff.
Definitely.
Things that come into our country that unfairly compete with us. But then countries put tariffs on our products. primarily it's hurting immediately. The pinch is being felt by the farmer.
Yes.
Now, you can speak directly to that.
Yeah,
it may be good in the long term, but right now there are a lot of people with USAID being cut, all those farmers who were selling food to foreign countries for aid, that's been cut, all this stuff. It does have a short-term, very, very detrimental effect.
Yes, and I personally believe, and there again, I don't want people thinking, I think I know all this, you know. But at the same time, I think on the short term, it is going to hurt, but long term, it'd be in picture. But if you look at it right today, there's so many people in the world, and they're going to eat so much. In some way, they're going to get food. So if China gets cut off something, we'll build up. When I was chairman of the U.S. Soybean Board back in 2010, a long time ago, we started developing other markets because we were selling 60% of our exports of soybeans to China. And once you have one customer that's buying that much, you're at a high risk of losing that customer. So we started expanding our operations into Africa, more into the Middle East and those things. And it has picked up. But it takes time to do that. It's not just the getting them to be our customer. It's the logistics of getting the product to them and all the things. So it takes time. And I think during that period of time, you're going to see an inflationary price to the customer.
Well, you know, the bad thing about China, of course, is, and Jack and Chuck chime in, you know, they're taking 60%, so they're our great customer. But if they decided they wanted to try to twist it a little bit and get lower price, they don't have the ethical considerations we do. They could just say, we're not going to take it for a year, starve our own people, unfortunately. You know, they don't have much compunction. So we'd be out for a whole year, short-term critical loss. They would find another market. You're right.
They have other markets. You know, they've got Brazil that Phil has to compete with.
Yeah.
That's why we need to improve our infrastructure. And, Phil, you go back to Water Resource Development Act was when George W. Bush was president.
Yeah.
They finally got
that authorized.
Yeah.
But it wasn't appropriated. But now, under Biden's infrastructure bill, there's money and they're actually working on Winfield. But we got to wait for Winfield, Clarksville, Saverton.
Yeah.
Then we'll get Quincy, and then they'll get Canton. There's two on the Illinois River, and one of them's in Brown County, LaGrange. So four of the seven, and this is huge. This, Jim and Tessie at one time thought that would be the equivalent of factory hiring 5,000 people for years. These are going to be prevailing federal wage iron workers, carpenters, and they're all going to spend that money in Quincy if we can ever get there. If, you know, Doge would get out of the way or whatever. Eliminating this USAID, I know they bought a lot of farm products, but where was that food going? It was feeding starving babies. So if we come to a point where the richest man in the world can take money away from these many times Catholic relief organizations that are feeding these starving kids, you know, I think what that is a big gift to Elon Musk's buddy, Premier Xi or Xi, because he makes billions in China. And we compete with China out there in the developing world. They got their Belt and Road. We got USAID, except now we don't. They have it all to themselves.
Yeah, because I'm going to look at this a little bit for, you know, the market share thing. Because the United States is basically all of the agricultural ground that's available is currently being used. In other words, we're not expanding on that. We may have a pasture that gets turned into row crops, or we may have row crops turned into pasture. But the reality of it all is it's still agricultural land.
And they're not making any more of it.
I mean, so we've maxed out on that, as opposed to Brazil, whose acreage is still expanding and will keep expanding as long as they've got land to develop.
They've got these big ports, right, Phil?
Yeah. And they also don't care if they take down the Amazon forest to build a farm.
Yeah, you know. That is a concern. I've been
get it right up on that microphone now, Phil. You're getting away.
That is a concern, you know, that they are destroying that. I've been to Brazil many times. I actually had some meetings with President Lula when he was president, and that is a concern. And going back to the thing with the cutting out of the funding of aid and that sort of thing, we've always been, the United States has always been, one of the primary functions has been to feed the world.
Absolutely.
And you know, we've done that very successfully over the years. So when you cut out some of those things and do it abruptly, and I agree with Chuck, it's damaging. It's just no way, boy, it's damaging. I hope it comes out with a better end result, But at this point, nobody knows.
Well, like you said, Phil, even the abruptness, I mean, if you had a transition and you could come up with some alternative logistics to feed these people, but just to automatically just eliminate it.
Well, and you know, I have said all along, I think a lot of the stuff that they are doing, meaning Musk and Trump are doing, is on the right track. But I think they ought to be using a scalpel with their cuts instead of a sledgehammer.
Yeah.
It doesn't seem like it's well thought out on what they're doing.
Well, the problem
Much
there
of
it's
is, been
though,
undone.
He's only got 4 years now, and he knows how short 4 years is because he had a chance to have 4 years. So I agree with you. I mean, I'm not defending Donald Trump in any way, but he is slash and burn because he wants to get it done while he still has control, because this is the way our democracy is set up. Mm-hmm. Joe Biden, Donald Trump, you couldn't get two more different people far as the way they look at things. Mm-hmm. And here we are, four people in this room, and we are all somewhere in the middle of those two. You know,
we're in the middle of those two.
So the problem is, and Phil, let's, you know, these tariffs, like Canada, now we have managed. Did you ever think we could manage to tee off Canada? I mean, they boo us at hockey games.
And why? And, you know, now I'm not going to sit here and lie to people. I'm a supporter of Donald Trump.
I know
basically,
you are, yeah.
Basically. But why, when you call people names, and why when you say Canada should become the 51st nation, why should the Gulf of Mexico become the Gulf of America? Now, Donald Trump's been more successful than I have, so he must know what he's doing, but I don't see it. But going back to China, I'd like to just, you know, say to the listeners, I think some of you know, but when I wrote the book, I tell a little bit about this, but not a lot. But in 1978, because of Paul Finley, I got to go to China. So I've had a relationship with China. I think I've been to China 9 times.
That's very early, too, right?
Yeah.
I believe,
and I talked to John Block, former Secretary of Ag. I talked to him, and I think we're the only two left from that trip who are still living and active. One of the things we come out of that was 78 was, and we're confident. Why, after 30 years, did Chairman Mao and the Communist Party decide they wanted to open up to the rest of the world? When they opened up to the United States, they was opening up to the rest of the world. Why did they? They didn't have enough food to feed their people. Now, you are right, Murray. They don't care how they treat their people. The leadership don't worry about their people. But they have to know. And when you have 1.4 billion people, and they aren't going to get fed, you know, you and I may not think so, but if you had kids you can't feed, you're going to take some big risk. And so they have to feed their people. Well, now let's fast forward to 2025. All of a sudden, why is China willing to say, I'll give a 90-day variance? They're saying, we can't feed our people unless they import. Why has China built up its naval force to equal ours or maybe greater? Because they know if they get into a conflict with us, we can dominate the sea and they can't get food. I maintain that China's biggest concern is food, and they've got to feed their people. And if they don't have that, we can block it off. We stop selling them food and we block the sea, they're going to starve their people.
Let me ask you a question here, Phil. Obviously, we're doing billions of dollars with China every year. I mean, and have been. You know, you were on the ground floor because we were doing nothing with China then. And so you were one of the key people that opened that up, and now they're our biggest trade partner in agriculture. All right, if we stop sending them food tomorrow, all right, can Brazil pick all that up?
Well, yes. The quick answer is not just necessarily Brazil, but South America can, because they would give up other markets, and we'd take those markets and they'd go there. But that kind of a transition, in my opinion, I think a lot of people agree, that would take time to do.
Well,
it
gets them into our hemisphere. Mm-hmm. I don't want, China's already in the Panama Canal.
Well, there is China. Yeah. China's big in Brazil. Right. Don't you kid yourself.
Well,
China's big in Brazil.
Well, but what I'm saying is we've got a whole ocean separating us from China aggression. But if the whole South American continent they're their number one trading partner instead of us, now we've got another problem, because they can come in and infiltrate, and how easily we could be dominated. They have so many people. Just think about a war, a traditional war, not a nuclear war. We, for every 10 of them we kill, 10 more can take their place.
Yes.
So, I mean, it really becomes very problematic. Plus, their one-child thing for so many years.
Mm-hmm.
There has to be some very unhappy men in China because there aren't any women to marry.
Well, I actually got the figures here someplace. I just looked at, you know, I think there's like two, almost three men to every woman.
Yeah.
Because of their, now they've dropped that one baby policy. But now, and I just looked this up on the internet last night. They're got a declining population. Now they're the second largest country in the world now. India is larger in population than they are now. And they're very concerned about their declining, their older population.
So, Phil, you probably stayed at the Black Swan there in Guangzhou, their classic hotel. It's filled with Americans who are adopting Chinese girls, or was way back when I went. I mean, the whole thing is set up for that because you have to stay there for a few weeks before you can take the little girl home.
And there's a lot of Chinese, there are a lot of Chinese girls in the United States now because they were rescued from abortion, because if you can only have one child, their culture, you want that child to be a boy. Now there's three men for every woman, and I think the government said, we got to quit doing this because these guys are not going to be happy. The bachelor life.
Yeah, and you know the thing of it, and I also went back and looked. Now I wasn't Chuck. I wasn't around when Marco Polo went over there in 1721.
Well, I was just in knee pants back then. So.
But I did go back in and do a little research on this for an article I was writing, asking for the book a little bit several years ago. Went in last night again, and you know some of the same problems we're having with China now. He saw when he went there in 1271 when he went in, you know, and the cultural differences. You see, I blame a lot of the problems we have with China since 1978. When I first went over there and as chairman of the Soybean Board and all these things. I blame a lot of it on our own leadership. And I'm not picking on Democrat and Republicans because, you know, I was kind of a friend with George H. Bush, you know, and he was one of our first liaison officers. But I kind of blame it on them. The Chinese, you have to stand up to them. Now, I'm going to give a little example. I had a man that I helped bring these over. I helped bring 49, was supposed to be 50, Chinese to the United States in 1979. And they worked on farms. I worked with the California Farm Bureau. I had one of those gentlemen work on my farm for a year. And so I learned some things. Well, first of all, a very intelligent man. They had 10,000 people apply, and they selected 50. So, you know, it was pretty selective. And we approved the one they selected and all that. But anyway, to make a long story short, I got this man, we called him Yan Sun. He came in, he said he could drive. I was okay, sure. You just drive the old pickup. Well, he'd been with me a few times, you know. We're driving down the road 55 mile an hour, and he just turned. And we ran through the ditch and through the gate. Well, we kept turning over, I don't know. But he got out of the field. And so I said to him after the old truck stopped, you know, I said, Yan Sun, what did you drive in China? He said, well, you know, I drove the pickup truck. I drove a truck like this, said, one time across the field. He's all the rest of the time he drove this little motorized
like a tuk tuk.
Yeah. And I said, is that right? He said, yeah, but I could drive. Now he told me he could drive, see? And I'll tell you another example. He did. Now, that's a culture difference, and I'll get to that. Another thing, went down to the feed store, and I was down there for something, getting some feed, paying a bill. He just picked up a soda to drink it. I got really relieved, and I said, Yan Sun, did you pay for that soda? He said, no, nobody told me I had to. And he was very nice about it. He, you know, said, I'll pay for it. I said, I'll give it to him. I think it was 20 cents or something. And went back 2 weeks later, and he picked up a can of bone. I asked him the same thing. He said, no, nobody told me I had to. Right then, I realized you have to tell them everything. Every time, nothing related. It didn't, you know, like us, we relate soda. You know, you pay for a soda, you pay for a candy bar. But he never could, and there were 49 of them, and I noticed it in all of them. They never related the fact that it didn't belong to everybody.
So now, it was being raised in that kind of
communist
totalitarian.
And you see that the grandpa, even back in the Ming times, the grandpa controlled everything. You know, everything belonged to grandpa, so we could just take what we wanted, eat it, and do what we wanted.
That sounds like a pretty good plan to me.
Yeah.
I don't know. We're all three grandpas now. That I'm not so sure.
Yeah.
Grandpa Freiberg doesn't want to pay for everything.
Yeah.
Thank you for that analogy. We're going to have to take a break because we have to go up to the Ursa Farmers Cooperative. I know you want to know what the farm markets are doing. Everybody wants to know what the farm markets are doing. We'll hear from them, and we'll also hear a PSA about matching donors for those who want to donate their organs, just
wonderful,
like Chuck and Jack have received organ donations. We'll hear about that, too. So stay tuned, folks. Temperature is rising. We are at 76 degrees. We head up to the Ursa Farmers Cooperative. How do the farm markets look today?
Good morning. Corn for July is down 3 at 4.45. September down 3 at 4.22. Soybeans for July is down at 10.50. August they're down at 10.47. Wheat for July is down 7 at 5.25. Soybean meal for July is down 4 at 2.92. Lean hogs for June is up at 100. Feeder cattle for August is up 1 at 297. Live cattle for June is up at 211.35. Crude oil is up at 61.23. And the Dow Jones is up 6 at 42,390. Thank you.
And thank you very much. We are back. This discussion, I've lost control completely during the commercial break. I will try to get some semblance of order back. Phil Bradshaw is here. He's our expert today on the panel. This is the Chuck and Jack Show. I'm just here, Mary Griffith, pushing buttons. We've been talking about tariffs. We've been talking about China. Mr. Bradshaw's been to China 9 times, he says.
I think 9
about
times.
On trade missions and everything. We started talking about tariffs. You know, it's really, tariffs aren't good or bad. We need them to equalize. So Mr. Trump is putting the hammer down, but it is going to be inflationary, and you agree with that. So we're going to suffer from it.
I think short term we will suffer from it. And you know, this other thing I wanted to say. I hope, Chuck, I hope you and Jack can agree with it. But you know, Ronald Reagan came in at a very high inflationary time. A lot of people gave the raising of interest rates credit for stopping that inflation. I give credit to Ronald Reagan and his administration of opening up channels for imports. They really opened up the channel of imports. So the supply went up as the demand stayed the same, forcing prices down. Now I think you have the reverse now. I think you have the exact reverse. And if it worked on the going down, it's going to work the other way on the way up.
Mm-hmm. So, Phil, they complain about, you know, we have a trade deficit with Vietnam. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, how does that bother me? They make T-shirts and flip-flops or whatever, and I buy them, and they're cheap. I mean, that manufacturing is never coming back to America.
No, it's not.
Because of that labor, right?
The thing that our economy is when we have more or less full employment, okay, and we have reasonable interest rates, all right, the economy is doing pretty well if we have both of those going on. But if, as you say, okay, inflation takes off and our job market goes to hell at the same time, which is a possibility in these next few months. If both of those happen, there's going to be pressure to make some changes.
Well, the housing market today, it was announced, this is the spring slump. They're having the worst spring they've had in decades with the housing market now, because it went from being a seller's market, now it's a buyer's market, but nobody's buying because the people who should be buying homes are permanent renters. They just can't afford to get in.
Well, in certain markets like that area in Florida, there are all these condo owners down there that are being priced out between assessments and damages and their insurance costs. They're saying, I can afford the condo, but I can't afford the maintenance or the yearly cost.
Well, let's talk about the future of the American farmer, since we have the best. He won't call himself an expert, but I say he's pretty much an expert. You know, there is concern. We're not making any more land. We're becoming more and more productive. Mm-hmm. We even have set-aside programs now. Somebody made a joke one time. You won't appreciate this, Mr. Bradshaw. I apologize in advance. And you know how a farmer doubles his income? He puts another post box down at the end of the road so he can get another government check for not doing anything. He's got a government check for not raising hogs. He's got a government check for not tilling his land. He's got a government check for protecting the quail habitat. You know, those things were important at one time. They still may be important. But the truth of the matter is, there is a finite amount of land, as we come full circle in this discussion. You mentioned Brazil could probably easily outpace us if they, you know, give them a couple of years of concerted effort, and they could. Right now, what is the future of the American farmer?
Well, you may think this is funny, but I've had the opportunity, you know, I've been appointed to committees or boards by 7 United States Secretaries of Agriculture, and I don't know that I've asked every one of them this, but I know that at least 3 or 4 I've talked to about this. We'd have more farmers today if we'd have never had a government farm program. government farm programs have helped the larger and non-farm people much more than it has farm people. You can't have a farmer out here tilling, back in the olden days, 240 acres. While he's raising these livestock and tilling out of 240 acres, he don't have time to farm the government. But when you turn around and you see doctors and lawyers and you see a wealthy big farmer, they can farm the government. So they know every farm, they know every program that comes along, and they figure out how to get the most money. And so that has been a detriment. So I believe fully, and I've talked to three or four sectors, that we would have more farmers today than we never had. Now, would food prices be the same? Food prices might have been a little higher. It may be more efficient the way we've done it. But the true matter is the farm programs really haven't kept a lot of people on the farm.
You know, Phil, something that Jack I'm sure would agree with, that's a very positive thing, is we're both involved with the Bicentennial of Adams County, and the FFA groups have been awesome. They have, just about every event we've had, they volunteered and staffed it, and our big finale out at the fairgrounds on September 6th, we're using all kinds of volunteer help. And I'm very impressed with these young people, so that gives me a cause for hope, Phil.
Oh, it does, me too. And you know, I believe the future is really great for agriculture. I've been saying all the way along, and a lot of them don't like it. I have the opportunity to speak to a lot of colleges. I've been speaking over at the Illinois College, someone's out here at Quincy University. Well, Jack lined that up a little bit. But I speak to a lot of the young people, and I'm saying, I don't know, maybe the rest of you won't agree with this, but I think that we have to stop, you know, and farmers are not going to like this, but we have to stop saying farmers have done this and farmers have done that. The truth of the matter is, most of us farmers, if we just follow the direction that the researchers and the companies tell us, we're going to have a good crop. You know, we got to learn how to follow directions, and that's the biggest thing we do. I didn't develop the seed, you know, the genetic seed that's so much better now. I didn't develop the soil test that we run on the move. You know, you got the what they saw soil doctor.
Oh my gosh, yeah, you can go over GPS now. We'll tell you exactly how much fertilizer to put on.
All I have to do as a farmer, and I don't do it very well. My son and grandson do it, but I don't. Is all you got to do is follow those directions. You're going to raise a good crop.
Well, this is interesting. You mentioned that you think farm subsidies or farm programs have hurt the American farmer. Why didn't Elon Musk come in and take his saber and his chainsaw, and why didn't he just say, look, you got to make it on your own. It's the start of a new growing season. Put your stuff in the ground. Do the best you can, and come fall, make it on your own.
Well, I think if you looked at most farm organizations and farmers, I hope I speak for them. I hope our farmers don't, you know, hope they don't throw, you know, mud balls at me as I go home. But I think most farmers would agree. With the insurance that we have, we've developed good insurance. Matter of fact, the late Merritt Sprague down here was a big leader in that under Jack Block and the Reagan administration. I think when you led it to the insurance, it had some things. But once you went to that, that's where your emphasis should be. It shouldn't
insuring
be...
Insuring the farmers.
Insuring the yields and the revenue of the farmers. And
so
I think
Merritt,
that's more.
Mm-hmm. We don't have too much time left, but Phil was involved way back at the beginning on what's now Interstate 72, AMPS. Adams, Morgan, Pike, Scott, and we just lost Kit Bond, who was the key individual to get that four-lane interstate quality crossing at Hannibal. So, you know, we have a debt of gratitude there. And then my friend Senator Durbin has announced that he said, Phil, is, hey, I got 18 months left, and, you know, I'm not letting up. But he'll, you know, we'll have a new senator as well. And Durbin represented the 20th Congressional District
back
when Phil was promoting what we called it the Central Illinois Expressway, right, Phil?
Yes, that's right. And I want to tell you something. I know, you know, I try not to quote political leaders and all that. I've always been a little politic, but I've tried to stay clear of it. And I'm going to paraphrase this.
That's why everybody likes Phil.
But you know, the last time I spent a little time with Senator Durbin, one of the things that I said to him, I said, well, you know, you've been great to come to Pike County to the New Philadelphia site. And I said, you know, you only got about 34% of the vote out of Pike County last time. He said, but it was the right thing to do. Now, you knew you had a good man there. Now, I did not support a lot of things that Senator Durbin has supported. I would have voted different on a lot of issues. But I want to tell you, as a Republican, a lifelong Republican, Dick Durbin was a good man, is a good man. He never had to my knowledge, he's never had a scandal associated with him, and he's never got in. He hasn't gone into this BS stuff between the president and them. He has been able to avoid those things, and And
you know, he never moved to Washington.
Well,
he still lives on Bates Avenue in Springfield.
A good example here recently is the work he has done on the Quincy Bay project.
Yes. It's amazing. I always say, you know, that's a sign of a good man, because Quincy and this area have turned their back on Dick Durbin. I mean, they have totally rejected him.
But he hasn't turned his back on us.
But he hasn't turned his back on us.
And I have to say something about his chief of staff, Pat Suter.
That's right. And you know, Mary, one thing.
Quincy man, yeah.
Quincy guy who never, I've tried to get him publicly recognized. You know, Amtrak, the airport, the college, the community, all these things that he's helped us. Jack said, we got $38 million to restore Quincy Bay, which we were going to, it was going to be a mudflat in 10 years.
Yeah.
Be a cornfield in about 20, Phil.
Yeah.
So anyway, they're getting ready to start dredging.
Yeah.
So we had a good man there. And as Phil said, ethically, he came out of Paul Simon and Paul Douglas before him. So that's in a great tradition. I hope we get a new senator who is in that same tradition.
I hope so, too. And Rush Limbaugh used to give Dick Durbin so much grief. And this radio station turned its back on Dick Durbin. And he became persona non grata here. And I was part of that, unfortunately, being told what I could and could not say and could not do. I'm bitter to this day, and I want to publicly apologize to Dick Durbin, not for anything I personally did, but the fact that I was employed here, and this radio station did everything it could to make Dick Durbin's life an absolute living hell. And I will say this, I think if I saw Dick Durbin on the street today, he'd still say hi to me and still be nice to me, because, you know, that's the kind of guy that he is, and I certainly would be kind and nice to him, because I think he's probably one of the best senators in the United States Senate, because he's not involved in all this stuff.
Yeah,
he's not calling everybody a name. He's not doing all this.
In Washington, people, you know, it's a big deal, office space, parking spots, whatever. Durbin has the coolest office in the Capitol. Also has another office over in the Hart Building and a little hideaway office downstairs in the Capitol. But it's the best. It was LBJ's office when he was Senate Majority Leader. There's 11 working fireplaces in the United States Capitol. Six are in that office. Pat Suter looks right down the mall there. So the point is, he's respected by his fellow senators. So sometimes the Democrats have been a majority, sometimes they've been a minority. He's never had to move.
Yeah, that's right.
That's for
sure. And, you know, I might just say one thing. But on my Republican hat a little bit, you know, I think that Dick Durbin got caught up in the Democrat movement. I don't think not knowing near Dick, near Senator Durbin.
He's not nearly as liberal. He is no Ocasio.
Yes, I think
he got,
I don't think he supported a lot of things that was going on there, but he knew to stay in leadership and everything, he had to kind of keep his mouth shut. Now, that's my assessment, Chuck. I don't know whether you agree with that.
That's how you stay involved in politics. So sometimes you got to know when to keep your mouth shut. Some of them don't know that, and that's why they don't last. We're out of time.
Okay.
So last statement.
No, he's a very skilled legislator.
Yeah.
So we got the whole package with him. Good guy, but really good at what
he
did.
The fact that he's resigning or saying, I'm not going to run again. He can keep that job till he dropped dead, or like Strom Thurmond was in the nursing home and was taken by ambulance every day for a vote. It's crazy.
I like to see leaders leave when they still have all their faculties and they're still doing a competent job.
Okay. What about 6 years from now?
And I don't
how long the term is.
Yeah.
Well, I don't like it when they stay on too long, and obviously their faculties are leaving them. That is not good for the American
Senator
people.
Simon told me, leave when you don't want to leave, and leave when people don't want you to leave. So I got a heads up on Durbin's announcement, so I texted him that. And the next day I was invited to his house when he made the announcement. He said, that was so great, because he loved Paul Simon like I did. He used that quote all day.
That's fantastic. We got to go.
Are we over? Hopefully we can.